You have a right to express emotions.
Anger, love, hate, sadness, confusion. It does not mean you're ill.
If you're down and out, seek help. Don't be scared. It can be very intimidating.
There are people listening and willing to help.
We have to innovate.
Get informed. Contact your local CLSC, Sun Youth, AMI Quebec, Forward House, or Prevention Suicide.
There's a place where dreams are born. It's across the sea and through the storm. Now listen, come with me to this magic hour in ecstasy.
You're listening to the very first episode of a new show called Other Worlds on Earth. It will air the first Thursday of every month live on CKUT. And on CKUT.ca, you'll be able to listen to recordings of the episodes after they air, far into the future. This is a radio show of unapologetic romanticism and utopian yearning for people with unlimited vision. You can expect deep dives into counterculture, counterhistory, altered states, ethnobotany, radical anthropology, esoteric explorations, and other worlds on Earth. What worlds? Other ones. Other than what? Other than the one you're familiar with. Where? On Earth, where we live. I aim for this program to be a small contribution to countering the cynicism and nihilism of our times, a lighthouse in the distance, keeping the light on all night, just for you. I also have a humble goal of creating a temporary new world for you to inhabit, in the space of an hour, and for you, the listener, to feel truly transported there. Leave your worries and doubts behind, just for this hour. Expand your mind and your vision, and see what you leave with. The topic coverage of this show will be broad, and many themes will be explored over the coming months. If you don't like one, you might like the next one. This episode, we'll be addressing the UFO question. A lot of interesting things have happened with this topic in the past 6 months, but for me, there was already an entry, or re-entry, into this world a few months prior to that. So let's begin.
I was invited to be part of a panel discussion in the past year called Anarchist Perspectives on Extraterrestrial Life. This was a question I wasn't focused much on at the time, but thinking more about it became a useful vehicle for pulling on a lot of threads I had been wanting to unravel. I'm interested in the expanding edges of what we consider possible. Another way of saying this is, I'm interested in the fringes of everything. Those on the fringes of society, but also fringe thought. Anarchism is considered by most to be pretty fringe thought, and I think it should remain so. I don't mean by that that anarchism should seek to be as freaky, unwelcoming, or as ridiculous as possible. What I mean is that, if it is to hold any relevance to others, it should be the avant-garde of the avant-garde, and seek to be a refuge for dreamers who are constantly rupturing the boundaries of what we think is possible. Possibility. Really feel the power of that word. Possibility. The anthropologist Wade Davis argues that the real value of other cultures, that is, the value of there being many, many diverse cultures throughout the history of the world, the real value of that to people, of any single culture like ours, is that it's proof that other worlds are possible. Margaret Mead said her greatest fear was that eventually all cultures of the world would either disappear or meld into one global monoculture, and no one would be able to remember any other possibilities of how life can be. Existing or previously existing cultures prove to us certain ways of life are possible, which may be very different than our own. But the main lesson shouldn't be that only those other specific worlds are possible, or that we need to emulate them, but that any world is possible. Not just another world, but many worlds, infinite worlds. I think we could also apply a similar logic to worlds outside of Earth. The recent attention on high-profile UFO sightings in the past several years by the U.S. military may be the most documented UFO cases in history. There's multiple forms of evidence by multiple aircraft and sensors verifying that there were indeed unknown aerial objects exhibiting behavior that defy the laws of physics as we currently understand them. And it's rumored that there's better evidence that hasn't been released yet. High-definition 4K quality video, which they apparently think we aren't ready for yet. So what we know so far is largely defined by what these objects are not. It's not an airplane. It's not a weather balloon. It's not a shooting star. It's not Aurora Borealis. It's not a drug-induced hallucination. It's not a non-drug-induced hallucination. This describes some of the most interesting cases so far. So what is it then? I don't know. But what I care the most about is that we have an unknown, and there's nothing more satisfying to me than seeing experts of the known be unable to explain something. These are often the very same experts who are part of a certain so-called educated class that is constantly teaching us that this world is the best and only possible world. And what does the unknown give us? Space. Space to dream. Space to dream of all sorts of wild possibilities. We're given such little permission as adults to use our imagination and creativity for things that don't make other people money. An unknown phenomena is a place that gives us that permission. Our task should be to expand that space of possibility, to reproduce more spaces of imagination where we have permission to truly dream. We're supposed to be the no blueprint people, the temporary autonomous zone people, the breaking the spell people. The idea of opening up spaces where we can imagine and experiment with different forms of life and push the boundaries of this reality is woven deeply into anarchism. One of my biggest takeaways from David Graeber's last book, which I highly recommend, is this simple point I've been trying to make so far, that nothing is inevitable and everything is possible. He paints a portrait of humans as dreamers who have demonstrated enormous agency in making and remaking their societies and are not simply victims of accidental environmental factors or crude instinct. We dream of things being different, and then we make them different. History proves this. Before you do anything to change things, you must dream, and you must believe that your dream is possible. You must imagine what lies beyond the acceptable boundaries of what others around you believe is possible. And one thing that can help us dream is the experience of awe, confrontation with the great mysteries. We had this constantly as children, but it's discouraged as we grow older. It's a feeling described by many who have seen UFOs, had a near-death experience, the astronauts who saw Earth from space. Suddenly, time stopped. They were totally enveloped in the experience, overcome with the enormity of it, and suddenly everything they thought they knew doesn't seem as certain anymore. They have more question marks than periods, and are somewhat comforted by the idea that there's more out there than we thought, that we don't understand everything, that we can't understand everything. They realize their vision was limited, and as anarchists, our ideal should be unlimited vision. In the context of change and the world being different, I'll go as far to say that if you don't believe in your own ideas about other worlds, then those worlds are not possible. They may as well not be, if no one believes in them. All worlds exist first as ideas, even if they're a large constellation of ideas. Demand the impossible is not merely a slogan, it's the program. And when there are infinite possible worlds, how can we really lose? The task ahead is to somehow take infinity and create freedom. I've been thinking about this question of why people so quickly, so urgently, and so passionately want to believe, even through their own cynicism, that UFOs are of alien origin. I don't think this is the only possibility, and in a way, it's limited vision which we should try to expand. But the idea of aliens from distant stars visiting Earth is still pretty outlandish. It's a symptom of what I described already, that the unknown is a blank canvas on which we are free to experiment and let our imaginations really get to work. I think people instinctively crave the opening of spaces like this in our culture, because we're imagination-starved. We're creatively starved. We want the freedom to imagine new worlds, even if they're not our own. But the more I think of it, the more I think that maybe not our own isn't totally accurate. There's a familiar humanity baked into these visions of extraterrestrial life. When we think of fictional portrayals of contact with extraterrestrials, there's no shortage of negative portrayals. There's been lots of analysis of what fictional portrayals of aliens say about our culture. But what I'm interested in is the non-fictional discussion of aliens. I've been exposed to a lot of people and experts thinking out loud about the possibilities of extraterrestrial life. What I've found is that the majority of it is surprisingly positive, and that's in spite of all the negative influence on the subject from Hollywood. Yes, there's the stories of unpleasant abductions, but on the whole, I feel like it's a mostly positive take on life outside of Earth. You hear lots of repeated themes, like they would be more advanced than us. Them being more advanced would obviously make them more peaceful and cooperative. They are thought to be so in tune with each other that they can communicate telepathically and speaking is not necessary. They're also typically portrayed as genderless or sexless. Why are there so many sightings of UFOs around nuclear missile sites? It's because they're trying to warn us, to save us, people say. I believe there's a rather transparent, self-reflective thing going on here. We're imagining that we could be more advanced, more peaceful, more cooperative, more in tune with each other, less restricted by gender. It is we who must save ourselves from nuclear war. We're allowed to imagine other worlds outside of Earth, just not other worlds on Earth. History is not on the side of the monoculture and all the Margaret Thatchers out there who tell us there is no alternative. The ruling class is resting on their laurels, so sure of themselves that alternative worlds are no longer threatening them, that in some moments we'll even admit maybe this world isn't so great, but always immediately follow up with, but it's the only one possible. Know, deep down in your soul, that your cynicism, your nihilism, comes from the cultural influence of Margaret Thatcher. I know this because I felt this. There's a bit of Margaret Thatcher in us all. We're told millennials, if that word means anything, are a notoriously cynical generation. Gen X imagined themselves as offspring of a failed revolution. Another world was possible, but it failed. And they were left to inherit that failure. Millennials imagine themselves as living in an endless void with no connection to any memory that anything can be different. What will we do when the last veterans of the failed revolutions of the past die off? Will there be anyone left to remember the feeling of another world being within reach, something you could believe in and fight for? But where there's a void, there's hunger. The younger generations today are hungry for meaning, mystical experience, spirituality, the old ways. Having been raised in such a cynical culture, sarcastic and scornful about anything with a whiff of meaning to it, who wouldn't get burnt out? Thule Kupferberg, a longtime New York anarchist known for his band The Fugs, summed up his feeling on this question of our current state of affairs shortly before he died. Nobody who lived through the 50s thought the 60s could have existed, so there's always hope.
We'll be right back.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month, so you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
TD and Production Nuit d'Afrique present Women of the World Raise Their Voices, 5 special concert evenings from February 1st to March 8th. Don't miss the grand premiere. Lidl's Cameroonian Slam, Brazilian songwriter Bia Ferreira, Lorraine Classen's 40-year career anniversary, The Roots Daughters Sound System, and Cora Virtuoso, Sona Jobarte. Discover the full program on festivalnuitafrique.com. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
So, you're listening to Other Worlds on Earth on CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca on the web. So, since that event happened, a number of things have happened that have changed my perspective a bit. I'm still down with everything I said, but at the time, I was largely using UFOs as a vehicle or a metaphor to talk about other things politically and as a cultural analysis. I didn't directly address the questions of whether we're alone in the universe or whether there were government cover-ups of UFO or alien-related material. The other two people on the panel who will be joining the discussion shortly addressed those questions a bit more directly, and I really wanted to have this discussion again now that new events have transpired since then and see if their perspectives have changed at all. It's worth briefly mentioning for context some more about what I alluded to in my talk. There have been a number of high-profile UFO sightings by U.S. military personnel in the past 15 years or so, which were recorded using not only video, but quite a number of other advanced instruments, which may have been less available in the past. So what makes these sightings interesting compared to the thousands of other ones is that because of the context in which they happened, a lot of resources were put into trying to understand what these UFOs were and whether they were a threat to national security. The most obvious concern of the military being that they were advanced technology developed by a U.S. adversary. It was revealed in a New York Times article a few years ago that a special team existed at the Pentagon for investigating UFOs, and it's around that time that some of these videos went public, along with the statements by numerous people involved that the actions, the movements of these objects defied the laws of physics as we understand them, which suggested it to be highly unlikely that countries like Russia or China had somehow made secret advancements in spacecraft that transcended known laws of what's possible on Earth with any technology that already exists or is even theoretically being investigated. They move incredibly fast and then stop on a dime, with no apparent signs of propulsion or any other way of propelling movement we're aware of. Even if they used forms of propulsion we're familiar with, which they don't, they travel at totally unthinkable speeds. Some of them do confusing actions like plunge into and out of the ocean. And these objects are very real, with ample data from lots of fancy military technology to back it up. And as I mentioned earlier, there's super high-quality HD video, which the government still apparently has of these encounters, which hasn't been released. That's been confirmed by numerous sources from that office at the Pentagon. So while what the public has seen is very interesting, it does have the grainy, faraway nature that a lot of UFO videos do. But that isn't because much better footage doesn't exist. It's just because they haven't released it. A few months after we did this panel, in June of 2023, a guy named David Grush went public in the media making explosive claims about this subject. He's a former intelligence official that worked with this government-sanctioned UFO investigation team, and essentially his job was to look into these incidents, and he also investigated rumors which have circulated for years that the U.S. government knows more than they say they do about this phenomenon. Well, he did his job, and in the course of doing his job, he says he interviewed over 40 firsthand witnesses to secret UFO and alien-related programs. All the witnesses are apparently longtime high-ranking officials who told him again and again that, yes, the U.S. government does know more, a lot more than they've been saying. They have several recovered otherworldly craft, apparently, that crash-landed on Earth. Some of those craft had bodies. That's right, bodies, or in his word, dead pilots. Or biologics. He said there's been an effort to reverse engineer UFO technology for many decades. This is also an international cover-up, with participation from other governments in crash retrieval by states like Brazil, Russia, and Italy. Apparently, the Vatican assisted the U.S. in recovering a crashed UFO there in the 1930s. So what properties do these recovered off-world vehicles have? Some are incredibly large, while others are small. One example is a 40-foot craft that, apparently, when you step inside, is the size of a football field. That's right, when you go inside the craft, it's dramatically larger, and they have an ability to somehow manipulate space and time. This same object was estimated to be able to harness enough energy to apparently power the equivalent of what's used by 70,000 homes in an entire year. He said he won't specifically say that who's behind all of this are aliens in the traditional sense of the term. That is, life from another planet who traveled very far to get here. What he says definitively is that they're non-human, and opens up the possibility there's an interdimensional rather than just interplanetary aspect to this. Grush says these 40 or so firsthand witnesses to these programs that he interviewed provided him with documents which proved these claims, and also info on locations of where some of this material is being hidden. He submitted all of this 1 year. He submitted all of this 1 year prior to going public to the Office of the Intelligence Community Inspector General. This is basically an office that oversees a wide variety of government agencies and programs and investigates mismanagement. For a whistleblower like Grush, despite how explosive these allegations are, it's essentially the office someone like him is supposed to contact to responsibly report issues that should be looked into. Right away, several people who worked alongside Grush came out in support of him. While not making any immediate claims of their own, stated that he is who he says he is, he really did the work he says he did, he's trustworthy, and that his claims have merit. It's worth mentioning that at a minimum, nobody at all at any point has claimed Grush didn't do the job he claimed he did, or that he's misrepresented his identity in any way. This hasn't always been the case with previous whistleblowers. The Inspector General, who reviewed all these documents, has been directly quoted all over the media as saying simply that Grush's claims were deemed credible and urgent. Numerous sources have indicated that as part of the follow-up to verify the claims, they called in all these 40 or so firsthand witnesses and interviewed them again to corroborate Grush's claims about what they said. And apparently it all checked out. Grush said he decided to come to the media after a year because the Inspector General hadn't appeared to take any real action in response to all of this, and he had received threats and intimidation since then. So he felt going public would protect him better and also put more pressure on all involved to give up the goods. Wild stuff. So about a month later, after a few interviews Grush did with the media, some congresspeople who were pretty interested in what Grush had to say set up a congressional hearing, which was broadcast live on television. This is in July. Two pilots that were witnesses to the UFOs whose videos were released a few years prior testified. I talked about these incidents earlier. And the third person to testify was David Grush, who repeated many of the same claims that he already had. There was nothing new a month later, but he answered questions by many members of Congress who were present. It's worth noting for interest's sake how surprisingly bipartisan interest in this has been. There's quite a number of Democrats and Republicans in the U.S. who have taken this issue, and Grush more specifically, very seriously. There was no mockery at this hearing. It was all taken totally seriously, which is an interesting sign of the cultural moment we're in, where these type of people are being listened to rather than just derided. Many times Grush said that because of contracts he signed with the government to not disclose certain classified information, he couldn't publicly answer a lot of the more specific questions that were posed to him without going to jail, like, where exactly are the craft and where are the bodies? This is, however, information he said he's already submitted to the Inspector General, which several members of Congress have also had access to, but that he can't say it on TV. He also said that he could talk much more openly behind closed doors in a SCIF with any members of Congress that wanted to speak to him more. A SCIF is basically a secure room that's built in such a way that resists surveillance. My understanding is that it doesn't let any radio signals in and has some other security features. There's secure rooms like this all over Washington, D.C. and in government buildings around the world. They're used for lots of different classified briefings. In other words, it's not a crazy thing to want to reserve a room like that if you're in Congress and you want to more securely discuss certain classified material. As you might imagine, immediately after this hearing, many congresspeople tried to set up a meeting with Grush in one of these rooms. To this day, 6 months later, not one successful SCIF meeting with Grush has occurred. He's apparently wide open with availability and wants to have these meetings, but the people controlling access to these rooms have consistently blocked the ability of anyone to schedule anything for them for this purpose. Quite transparently, they don't want more people to know the details of Grush's complaint. There's clearly enough people already now who know too much, and it's getting out of hand. There have been several other private hearings since then, which various members of Congress have attended, including one in the past month, where some congresspeople were finally given access to at least some of the information contained in Grush's complaint to the Inspector General. Everyone who was present, around 15 people, pretty much said the same thing. This is not a joke. Grush's claims have merit. And it's like pulling teeth getting this information from the people holding it. They clearly don't want to be forthright with it, which says something in itself. The former, not the current, but the former Inspector General, is supporting David Grush's claims and acting as his lawyer. So with first-hand experience in that office and how it works, he's advising Grush on how to walk the fine line of revealing enough to enable further inquiry and not enough to go to prison. It's worth mentioning something else significant that happened recently, which is that New York Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, put forth a bill before Congress that would have legally forced any agencies with secret UFO programs to come forward, gave special legal protection to whistleblowers, and contained over 20 pages of very specific language about recovered off-world vehicles, non-human bodies, and non-human intelligence as examples of things that need to be disclosed and can no longer remain secret. This bill had a lot of support, but was vigorously opposed by the intelligence community and several members of Congress close to them. The language in the amendment heavily overlapped with claims made by Grush, communicating that Schumer and others were privy to information which validated his claims and felt the need for that specificity. The bill was significantly compromised in the end by these adversaries, and most of the important language was removed just before Christmas. It's worth mentioning, to those less familiar with the U.S., that Chuck Schumer is a very prominent senator who is very influential in Congress and in no way considered kooky or obsessed with conspiracies. Yes, the more kooky congresspeople are very involved, but plenty of less kooky ones are as well. Mike Rounds, who co-authored the bill with Schumer, was asked about the term non-human intelligence and why was it important for that to be included in the language, and he said, quote, "It was not by accident, let's put it that way." In the past week, a lawyer close to the vanguard of these disclosure efforts suggested that as many as 40 firsthand witnesses could be coming forward this year after having been encouraged by seeing Grush come forward and living to tell about it. So it's potentially exciting times ahead, and this issue isn't going away anytime soon. Following this since June, it seems to me that at a bare minimum, Grush's basic claim that he interviewed over 40 self-identified firsthand witnesses to these alleged secret programs is credible. I've been pretty convinced that he is who he says he is and that he did what he said he did. I'm not 100% convinced yet that there are indeed hidden bodies in off-world craft stored in a hangar somewhere. I want to believe, but I'm not 100% there and want what most people would probably want, to see the evidence for myself. But I also find it strange, the idea that not one, not two, but over 40 people deep in the government, career, intelligence, and military people with top secret clearances would all in concert be sharing the same delusion. It feels like there's something there, and we might find out more soon. That's what I think, but let's hear what some others think. I'm joined now by the other two comrades who spoke on that panel I mentioned at the beginning of this, and now we're going to do round two of that discussion together. Almost a year later, and see where we land.
All right, hi you guys. Nice to be sitting down and talk again about this.
Yeah, hi.
Who'd like to start? Me? All right. So I'm thinking back to the conversation we had last winter, and all three of us shared a different perspective on the phenomenon. And for me, one of the angles that I came at this this issue was looking at it from a lens of parapolitics and the conspiratorial political power aspect of UFO disclosure and alien contact. And just, I really don't want to rehash the entire conversation we had, because today I think it'd be interesting to talk about how our ideas of this have progressed since the amount of disclosure that we have had. And so just really briefly, when I say parapolitics, so what that refers to, a lot of people don't really know this term, but it means political practices, arrangements that are unacknowledged or intended to misinform, obfuscate a hidden agenda or a flow of power. So I like to think of when we're talking about UFO disclosure and the history of U.S. government and governments worldwide covering up any evidence of UFOs or discussion of it. I'd like to think about what isn't being acknowledged and what they've tried to keep under wraps. And so an interesting document that I like to refer to is a Durant report, or Robertson panel report from 53. And basically, this was a scientific advisory panel that talked about UFOs and what to do around the discussion of UFOs that was becoming rapidly a really popular pop culture phenomenon at that point. And the discussion really centered around trying to contain that. So there's a lot of suggestions that it could be threatening, but they wanted to reduce this mystery, stop the popular interest. So, you know, get everyone to just stop being intrigued, conspiratorial about it. And the approach that they had was using various actors to help them do this. So this would be calling in scientific voices, getting them to really give a rational explanation for what people were seeing with their own eyes. So, you know, it could be explained by weather phenomenon or so on and so forth. Using a lot of other different actors that could minimize the amount of existential crisis, mass hysteria, panic, or weaken U.S. hegemony. So this could be also things like ad agencies. They suggested using Disney to help give a counter-narrative to what people were seeing. And even so far as going into talking to things like amateur astronomy groups. So this is something that's been going on for decades of, you know, how to manage this, the phenomenon. And, you know, with that as a basis, I like to, I like to say that anarchism is a bit of a conspiracy. We think that there are people with power, capitalists, who work together to maintain their position of power. I think that the state operates in similar ways. And so I think that there is a way to look at UFO disclosure with a bit of a conspiratorial lens that I think helps illuminate maybe what's going on, helps us ask questions. Because one of the things that I think that the state is aware of, and this is a very famous essay by Hofstadter writing about the paranoid style of American politics. He wrote a lot about how people tend to act and believe in things that are bizarre, they're irrational, they're paranoid, and that this is something that can really destabilize the power systems that are in place. So if people have a sense of suspicion and they act in ways that are feeling as though they're always under attack, foreign governments, some kind of authority, people in positions of power. And that's something that's pretty powerful. Using a paranoid style can be used to destabilize the power be, but it can also be used to discredit things that are becoming powerful. And that's where we come to disclosure. And I think that if we fast forward to recent UFO disclosures, I think one thing that really has changed for me when I'm looking at how are the parapolitical powers treating the conversation of disclosure. And for me personally, I think that there's something very interesting happening, because the aim, I think, has moved from let's neutralize this phenomenon, let's give a rational explanation. And we've since gone through various decades of technical, military, industrial complex, hell world, we're accustomed to hearing about things like unmanned aircraft, drone warfare. We talk about space colonization. There's a lot of things that were sci-fi fantasy that are like really commonplace. We talk about like citizen rocketry. These are things that just happen now. And so we've really gone from like, give them rational explanations to kind of saying, you know, it's not a big deal. It's not a priority. Of course, we have a UFO program. You know, like if we're thinking about like things that we see and things that we hear in terms of recent UFO disclosure and how so much of the conversation is about congressional hearings, it's about documents, it's about things like that, when I think that people seeing a floating cube with an orb inside of it as a UFO should really be one of the most transformational things ever. You know, we think that, you know, I should be asking, you know, I should know, like, where was I when I heard that there were actually aliens or that we saw confirmed UFO video? Like, and I don't know, it kind of landed with a bit of a plop, you know? And I think that that is a bit of the narrative being contained and a different approach being provided to us by the powers that be, because we've been given all this evidence and we've been given all this thing, and it's really like fourth page of the newspaper, and it's really surprising to me. I think if you'd asked me years ago when I was a kid, maybe dreaming of this moment, you know, what it would look like, I don't think it would look, I was surprised at how it actually turned out. And so that's something that's really interesting in terms of managing the paranoid, the paranoia, because we're also in a context of mass paranoia. We're coming off the end of the rise of QAnon cults, or the hysteria over Antifa terrorists, or January 6th. We've gone from the trucker convoy. So there's a heightened state of paranoia, and I think that this is. Been a semi-successful psyop in how disclosure's been handed to us. And that's kind of what I've kind of landed on since our discussion.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds to me like you want to see the bodies.
I want to see the bodies.
And everybody else does also.
But have we got to the point where seeing the bodies would just, like, you know, people would maybe say that's interesting and move on. And it's wild because this is a whole genre of science fiction. Yeah. What happens when contact happens? Yeah. And I never would have imagined this is how it would be.
So this gets into the presentation I did at our panel at that event last year, where the way I'm thinking of it right now is like, which would happen first? That there's the bodies are revealed in terms of... these U.S. military government disclosure programs that are being discussed at a pretty high level and in the media now, as was talked about, or that life is like confirmed to be found on an asteroid or on another planet or on a moon of one of Jupiter's moons. Like, there's a lot of there's a lot of hype and effort in the sort of astrobiology world about that possibility. And so that's more what I was talking about in, and likely that would be microorganism life of some kind, but could be something else too, less likely, but possible. And that is something I'm really interested in. I think that the situation now, the part of the question of life existing off of Earth that is most interesting to me is the sort of evolutionary history of life on Earth, and the basic paradigm, like scientific paradigm now, is that life originated on Earth. But the amount of time that could have happened in, based on the earliest fossil evidence and the earliest signs of water on Earth, is like relatively narrow in the scheme of the planet. It's like a 500 million years, give or take, like it's, you know, which is not that long, that whole from not life to microorganisms would have happened. And as the earliest fossil evidence of life gets pushed further and further back, and the earliest evidence of water stays in the same place, basically, that gap gets narrower, which for me seems like the kind of situation where things are building up for a paradigm shift of, no, actually, life didn't originate on Earth. It already existed when the Earth formed and then arrived on Earth. For people interested in that, the term is like panspermia, which I find is kind of a weird term, but it's what to look up for this kind of theory. But for me, what's interesting about it is that if that is the case, as it seems like there's some indications, then that means that there's a broader cosmic ecology that life on Earth is a part of. And evolution has happened here, but also that is happening in parallel in other places, and how far that extends and what other branches of it look like is like a whole big question, which intersects with these questions about alien life and UFOs in the way that is more like commonly, like more present in pop culture. But it's still, I think the similar sort of the big reveal that is talked about in terms of UFO disclosure, the similar thing would be the finding of whatever kind of life, even if it was just microorganisms, and then the genetic sequencing of that. And then there's like a earliest common ancestor kind of analysis that can be done. And if that was done and it was clear that that was prior to or different than the life that we see on Earth, but had some similarities, but like enough difference in time that it had to come from earlier, then that would kind of be that smoking gun that actually, and that could actually happen at any point in the years to come. So that's, and then we also talked about, had sort of fun, more speculative political exercise of like, okay, if there is contact with some sort of extraterrestrial life that has, is not just passively observed in the way that the microorganism would be, but has some agency of some kind or some capacity to be engaging with human and Earth life in more substantial ways.
A little green man.
Yeah. Then what are the political implications of that for anarchists mm-hmm. on Earth right now in terms of what kind of relationships do we imagine having with other kinds of life, which then gets into ecological questions here, where we should be asking and are asking these questions of what kind of relationships do humans have with other life on this planet now? And that's very dominating, very exploitive kinds of relationships. And so what could be different or should be different about relationships with life that is on elsewhere in the universe and not just on Earth? And the sort of scenario that immediately comes to mind for me is that obviously if life is coming from such a different background, then it would likely be relating in very different terms to any of these kind of questions than we do. But there's some very basic aspects of what's happening on the planet now where like any kind of life would probably recognize a biosphere of some kind, like mm-hmm. see some value in the biosphere. And then would also, it's very, very obvious that what's happening right now is that biosphere is being destroyed. So like there would be a potential, it's not hard to imagine in that kind of basic context that if there was any value put on that biosphere by any other kind of life, that they'd be like, well, that's got to stop. Like, that's not...
Yeah, they'd be disappointed.
Yeah, disappointed.
I mean, I'm disappointed.
Possibly staying away because they're like, bad news, what's happening there? But if there was contact, we were engaging in any way, then like...
They just think we're messy and leave.
Or they decide that they got to... Like, we're not succeeding in dealing with this obvious problem, so they're going to... stop this stuff from happening that clearly shouldn't be happening. Any kind of life could see this stuff shouldn't be happening and try to stop it. And so you get it, like sometimes people are like, oh, we get in a war with aliens or whatever, like a fight. And it's like, maybe we'd join them. Like maybe,
why not?
Maybe they'd have basic goals as life about life on this planet that they'd be trying to stop some of this ecocidal stuff from happening. And then if that's the case, I'm down. We'd be on the same side.
That's what side you're on?
Yeah, totally.
I don't know if this side has been very well defined. I'd like to know a bit more about it before I decide if I want to join it. Although it doesn't actually seem like there, if there is some, you know, non-human presence that we're not aware of visiting, it doesn't seem like there's much evidence that they're negative. I mean, if they have such superior technology, they probably could have just taken us out, like, pretty effectively by now. So I don't know. It's like, might be like an observate, you know, whatever. If that's what's really happening, might be more of an observation thing or mm-hmm. a wait and see kind of thing. Or, I mean, it might be that, yeah, might in the sense of observation, it might be, you know, similar to how we want to observe like other animals and in their habitat and see what they're doing and stuff.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it would probably be pretty interesting. You know, I think humans have some pretty interesting goings on, but
yeah, totally.
I always wonder, and I mean, I know, you know, the show we talk about utopias, for example, and that's kind of where I land is even if we, you know, the sentient, intelligent, extraterrestrial life landed here. And, you know, considering that perhaps it has, will we ever actually get to have a, you know, a sense of truth about the situation? And I think that that's one of the more frustrating things when I think about this is something that should be so transformative and so significant has been kind of provided as like a limited hangout to us. And, you know, it's one more way that the state really limits and frames all the beauty and the joy and the excitement that we can experience in our lives. And it really resonates to me in that way. So, you know, is this this power, this governing power, going to intervene in any kind of relationship or understanding of any extraterrestrial life or crafts or what have you, technology.
I don't know. I feel like potentially we're closer than we ever have been to this idea of disclosure. And it's like, I don't know. It's like, if you go over the course of people being interested in UFOs, over the course of the past few decades, you know, there's been this longstanding, a lot of the stuff that Gresh says is sort of like a UFO community wish list. Like, it's like he just checked all the check boxes. Like, yes, you're right. Yes, they do know more. Yes, they do have the bodies. Yes, they do have recovered craft. Yes, they are trying to reverse engineer it for military purposes. Like, and, you know, like, so that's been like a popular thing to say for like a long time. But in the past few, like a few years ago, there was almost this sort of like mature UFO position or whatever that was like, oh, our position is that we think that the government actually is just as clueless as we are, and they don't know what, nobody knows what any of these things are. But yeah, I don't know. Gresh came along, and now I kind of, I don't know. I that's put a lot of doubt into it. And just, I mean, even if it turns out to be, you know, one big nothing burger, as everything in this community ever has turned out to be.
That's what they want you to think.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. I know. I'm trying to count. I know. I'm supposed to be countering the cynicism. Sorry. But that, you know, even if it turns out to be, he will still be, to date, the most credible seeming UFO whistleblower, credible seeming, you know, guy in his role that's ever come about. And so if nothing else, regardless of what happens, like, I feel like we're definitely like in kind of unprecedented territory. Like, yes, there's been other whistleblowers, and yes, like, I am sympathetic to the idea of like, I push back on people who say like, oh, the government is terrible at keeping secrets. Like, how, how could they have, you know, kept something like this secret for so long? It's like, first of all, the government effectively keeps lots of secrets. And I've listened to interviews with people that like, you know, like, were privy to lots of secret stuff, like with the Manhattan Project and et cetera. And during the periods when that needed to be classified, like, there were not many leaks. And the thing is that on the other side of it, like, yes, there are leaks. And like, if you look back, there's tons of, you know, ex-military and intelligence people that have come out and said similar things to what Gresh has said, but nobody takes it seriously. So like, does that count or does it not count? Like, maybe there are leaks, but there aren't leaks of like the materials or documents that would definitively prove their claims. And so like, you know, derision and mockery are like a pretty powerful, you know, if there is something being hidden, derision and mockery seem to be the primary tools to keep people from looking further into like people who have made the same claims. And now that has been turned down a lot. And there's a lot of people like taking it more seriously. And supposedly there's a lot of documents and people behind Gresh to back up the kind of stuff he's saying. So I don't know.
But I think
What do you guys think about that? What do you think about this moment we're in?
Well, I think that, you know, I think I definitely agree. I think that, you know, the ufology community, they got exactly what they wanted. They got everything they wanted. And I mean, think that it's something to consider of, you know, they've been, you know, banging their head against the wall for decades. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, yes, here are the documents. Yep. And here's like some very well-credentialed officials who can verify it. And so, you know, and there's no cults, there's no mass suicides, there's no, you know, we didn't even storm Area 51, you know, none of, and so why is that? And also, I think that Gresh is a really credible figure, and that's also the perfect candidate, someone with his background and his connections. To me, this is, there couldn't be a better person to come out and neutralize the, like, potential, like, mass upheaval and like social outcome that could come with disclosure. And, you know, I'm not saying that I think Grush is an op or anything. Like, I think he's pretty credible, but I think that that's one way that the power of the paranoid style is well, of paranoia is very well understood by the powers that be. So of course, I think that there's a way to fold in the, you know, the fringe UFO people rather than cast them out and perhaps contribute to the like destabilizing of a bunch of people who believe in UFOs really strongly with a lot of evidence backing them up. What about you?
Yeah, I have been thinking about this and what different ways to interpret it. And one basic thing that comes to mind is that assuming that he did interview a bunch of people and there's like, and these things came out, it's very likely that different pieces and different accounts are for different reasons. Like there's not just like one explanation for it all. Mm. Like, for example, I think it's likely that some of these stories are just something that someone made up at some point and then got passed along and stuff. Like the Vatican one, I had come across reading about stuff and someone did like debunking specifically the Vatican one.
That's the one I really wanted to.
Right. Yeah, yeah. 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 And that's been said for, it's been a story that's circulated for a long time. And so like, but I think to your point, I think that person using that Vatican story was they're using that to sort of discredit the whole thing a bit, being like, look, this
I think it was a PSYOP.
Yeah, like maybe including some known not true things is like, so I think that's likely part of it. I was trying to think, okay, what are other things that could be going on here? And it doesn't necessarily account for all the things, but something that came to mind is that, so my experience with the US military industrial complex and like research world is based here at McGill, literally across the street, the engineering department. And they for decades got funding from the US military and did research on different weapon systems, thermobaric explosives. So this was something that, and so in looking at how the US military works and how their research works, they've got a shit ton of money for going towards lots of different kinds of research. There's DARPA, there's other more secret stuff. There's like massive, because they just know they have to keep a technological edge in order to like engage in global military conflict competition. So they're constantly just throwing money at any way to like get that edge. And if they could try some weird stuff in terms of research techniques, and potentially a thing that this gets into the reverse engineering part, they maybe are giving weird objects, where those came from, how those were, maybe they were created, whatever, weird things to people under top secret clearance and saying, try to figure out how this works. Like, give us your analysis, your thing on it. And those people, they are hoping that that person in the process of trying to understand a thing, this weird thing, they come up, they're like, okay, I think this is how it works. And that's a theory about a thing that could be built. So it's just like innovation through artificial reverse engineering kind of thing. And in that kind of situation, this is like the way double blind studies work. The person giving the medicine or the administering thing, they don't know whether it's real or not. They're in the same state of not knowing. So the person handing over that thing to the person who would reverse engineer it, they also don't know what it is. They've just been told, okay, here's this thing. It came from wherever, and give it to this person and explain the situation and get them to try to reverse engineer it. And this kind of sets up this like weird sort of secret little cells of in sort of disconnected. So no one knows the full picture. Clearly there would be people planning and running these studies, but more likely if there was like people coming forward and being like, yeah, I was involved in this weird thing. They would all be the people who weren't running the studies. They would be the people who are like participating in it unknowingly. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's just like I don't think that would explain all the things that Girls just talked about, but maybe some of it would fit in that kind of model. And the US military doing really weird shit to try to get a technological edge and do research, I'm like, oh yeah, totally. That's that is something they would do. But I feel like it's kind of an endless prompt or like brainstorm of like, and what other things might be going on with these? And some of them are even less probable, more weird. I mean, it's been mentioned the interdimensional version, time travel.
Well, you know, we are right across the street from McGill, and mm-hmm. that's a dirty university with
totally,
you know, home of MK Ultra. Also, mm-hmm. we had Professor Don Derry, who is a big UFO believer, who interviewed a Professor X, I think they called him, at McGill, who's an abductee. So there's someone in the campus got abducted. Okay. There's all sorts of weird stuff going on at McGill.
The Professor X.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. Anyways, so I believe it. I'm open to all sorts of ideas of what's going on.
Yeah. One that specifically with that last line you were talking about of the other senator, I forget his name, saying non-human intelligence mm-hmm. was a really important line. And it sounds like a lot of that is like biological non-human intelligence. But when I see just the term in isolation, non-human intelligence, I'm like, oh, like artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
like
exactly. AI.
And then...
But it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, right? It sounds a bit coy when he says it at this point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. and so just like if they're finding very advanced technologies that are clearly bordering into organic, but actually are like machine-based or something, then what implications would that have for, because people have said like it's lots of things could be going on that aren't necessarily life traveling from another planet, which there's right. a lot of reasons that it would be really physics wise, mm-hmm. really difficult, but non-organic stuff being sent really long distances. Like that's already what humans do. We send probes because it's way easier to send mm-hmm. a probe, but a very, very advanced probe could simultaneously be arriving and doing weird shit. And also not be necessarily, this is another thing, it's like, if they can travel that far, why are they crashing? Like, on a basic level, it doesn't add up. But if it's, our very preliminary experiences with artificial intelligence now show that it's not necessarily good at everything it does.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, people make mistakes. And non-people also, maybe.
Machines make lots of mistakes.
Yeah, machines make mistakes. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing about, like, them coming so far, I mean, it only seems difficult to imagine when we're thinking about it in terms of, like, you know, they got in, you know, jet fuel-powered vehicles right. and then right. went, you know, several light years away. I would suspect that if it is some great distance being traveled, that... it just isn't that difficult. Like it's not as difficult as, you know, a 747, like having to go to Mars or something. Like it's, you know, there would clearly have to be some other type of technology that is, it's not using like propulsion as we understand it. It's like taking some kind of shortcut or whatever. I mean, the interdimensional thing I think is like a thing that, I've heard a lot of people in the UFO community recently, like get excited about because it sort of like solves that question. It's like, oh, they're just here all the time. Mm-hmm. They just gotta like, they're just able to change the channel, and we're not able to change the channel. Essentially,
God, I want it to be true.
It really gets into time travel.
I know this is what I'm saying. I want to get off. You know, I want to get out of here.
Whether it's in the same, like it can be like they are a variation on humans, or like a variation on Earth, and then the past and far future especially is just kind of it's like also a variation on the same place but different.
So unfortunately we are almost at the end of the program. It is February 1st, 2024. It is 8:58 p.m. Eastern. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, CKUT.ca on the web, and the program is Other Worlds on Earth. This is the first episode, and if you search for Other Worlds on Earth on CKUT.ca, you will be able to, after this airing is done and after all future airings, you'll be able to listen to recordings of the shows. But we have maybe like 30 seconds-ish left. Any like closing thoughts?
I would like to see the end of all terrestrial governments.
Very good.
If we could imagine life from another planet, we could imagine life without states and capitalism here.
Mm-hmm. That's a good place to leave it. All right. Till next time.
information at blacktheaterworkshop.ca. This is a Black Theater Workshop and Prairie Theater Exchange co-production and CKUT co-presentation.
Show pour le monstone.